listening to Beside Stillwater's Netcast, a tabernacle service of Stillwater's home churches and worship center.
Today, what we celebrate and what our lectionary readings are for the purpose of they're for the purpose of drawing our attention to how fickle we can be. In most other years in the lectionary, what we do is we talk about on Palm Sunday, and in most other churches, we talk about how Christ comes into Jerusalem riding on the peace donkey. As a king, he's being heralded. He's being expected to be the military leader who will deliver them from Roman bondage and release them from their captivity, even in their own country, by the Roman authority. The folks that are there for all kinds of reasons. But what they do is they recognize that Jesus is Messiah. They recognize him as king. They've seen the miracles. They know what his deal is. They know that he is approved by God. And I believe it was last week we talked about how there was thunder. And Jesus said, that was for your hearing. You know, it was for your benefit, you know, that you hear my approval from God. And what he does is now he's coming into the city, and this is all planned stuff. What he did is he created this scenario so that he could come into the city and that the verses from Isaiah and that we just read in other verses as well about him entering. What he does is he stages this, and what he does is he comes in riding on a peace donkey. That the war is over. And nobody really notices that, do they? Our lectionary this week on Palm Sunday doesn't really address that. The only thing that it addresses is it sort of begins with, from Mark chapter 14, how the Passover festival, the festival of unleavened bread, is beginning, and that the chief priests are plotting against him. And what he does is he kind of just plods along and plans for their celebration of Passover. What's interesting at the beginning of this in Mark is that there's this woman who comes in, and we talk about that a lot. She has an alabaster jar of costly ointment of nard, and she broke the jar and poured it over his head, and you know, and the room becomes angry because it's a waste. It's costly. And I'm one of those guys who would probably say, look at that waste. Look how awful that is. But he says that she's preparing his body for burial. He's beginning to unpack the story for them that you guys are celebrating. You guys are enthusiastic that I'm here as the king, and that what I'm going to do is I'm going to overthrow the Roman authority on your behalf, and we're going to win. And that is not what his plan is. He sees things the way they truly are. He sees things from God's perspective, not from man's perspective. He sees that the temple system is corrupt. He sees and understands that the reason that they're in this kind of bondage is because of who they've become. the way that they've worked out religion to be able to freeze people out and keep God away from people, the way that they've created barriers and hurdles. And he understands that. And the only way that he can stop this and open the borders, so to speak, of the kingdom to all who want to come is he has to put an end to the temple system. And he has to do it, in a sense, legally. He has to, in a sense, make one final offering so that there can never be another offering again. So that they will not be able to atone for their sins. So that they will not be able to pay their way out of jail. So that they won't be able to take the responsibility of doing the right religious stuff so that they will be thought of as sinless in God's eyes. Truly, only in their own. But they're partying. They're celebrating. Because he's coming down off of the mountain. He's riding into town. And he's making a show of the powers. And he's getting ready to do that. And they misunderstand this whole concept of what he is actually going to do. And our lectionary tonight spends most of its time on his suffering. Spends most of the scripture on his agony. Of his inward struggle with, I can't believe I got to do this. Oh, this is going to hurt. His wrestling with God over this. I hope that you all did your homework. Last week, the scriptures for the following, for the next week, are always on the back of your bulletin, and this is not a time for us to forsake that, to read ahead, because this is Holy Week. You need to read these. This is two entire chapters, which we are not going to go over here, but part of what we're going over, the scriptures that I wanted to focus on for this time, is... So he sent two of his disciples, saying to them, "Go into the city, and a man carrying a jar of water will meet you. Follow him, and wherever he enters, say to the owner of the house, 'The teacher asks, where is my guest room where I may eat the Passover with my disciples? He will show you a large room upstairs, furnished and ready. Make preparations for us there.' So the disciples sent out and went to the city and found everything as he had told them." You see, he prepared. "And they prepared the Passover meal. When it was evening, he came with the 12. And when they had taken their place and they were eating, Jesus began to say," he says, "I tell you, one of you will betray me, one who is eating with me." They began to be distressed and to say to him, one after another, "Surely it's not I." Truth is, there's a question mark at the end of that. They're really asking, could it be me? Did you ever do that? Did you ever say something out loud? You're making a declaration. You're saying, you know, no, not me. And inside the reason that you're making that declaration is because inside you're saying, could it be? And that's what these guys are doing. Some of them are zealous. Some of them think, you know, that this, some of them believe that this is going to be a military thing. Apparently Judas does. Judas thinks that he's getting the high sign from Jesus, you know, to go and do what you must do. But this woman who wastes this ointment on him, he takes as an opportunity to say, "I'm being prepared for burial." Could it be that Judas kind of saw that as a sign? Could Judas have been looking at all the things coming together in such a way that he saw this as his solemn duty? Do you think that maybe he just had in his head, I don't like Jesus, so I want him handed over? Do you think that was his motivation? I don't. How many times do what we do is we see and we look for signs to approve the things that we want to have happen, and we look at everything line up just perfectly for that, and find out that what we did is we sought out those signs and ignored everything else and went running headlong into trouble. And Judas here is doing exactly that. But Jesus told them. He told them what was going to happen. And he keeps telling them, and they keep not hearing. And today, me, Glenn, and John were up at Lehigh Valley Grace Brethren Church, and I got to speak a little bit there and tell them about what we're doing as a church, what we're doing in ministry, thanking them for helping us. And Larry Humbert, the pastor there, was talking about how the crowd was at the wrong parade. How about it? That they thought that they were at a parade heralding Jesus as the king, as the military king, and it was the wrong parade. The parade that Jesus is doing is the peace donkey parade. The parade that Jesus is doing is the one where, no, I've come to die for Rome because I love them too. They're celebrating the wrong thing, and the evidence of that, as we read through this, and as we celebrate Holy Week, as we go through and remember this, as we sit down and read these two chapters, as we celebrate Maundy Thursday and Good Friday and the Vigil of Easter, as we go through all those days, remembering what our salvation cost God. Larry was saying today, what are we at the right parade? Because they're expecting one thing, and as we read through this, where are all those people? Where are they? As long as he's going to lead them into battle and that there's going to be violence and that they're going to take back what they believe is theirs, they're on board with him. And as soon as he does, the biggest sacrifice, the one that isn't so obvious, actually sacrifices himself for them. Something highly spiritual. Something they should have recognized from the scriptures that we've just read from their past. Something that he modeled after the scriptures that they should have ingrained in their souls. They didn't see it. They looked at it as a military defeat. And they left him. Everybody who had the palms, everybody who were laying them down at his feet, everyone who were taking off their coats and laying them down, all of them left him. They left him. There's three at the cross. Out of the multitudes that are heralding him a week before as king. Well, a few weeks ago we talked about from Jeremiah. Does anybody remember what the new treaty is? What the new covenant really is? Because what they failed at is the very thing that Jesus is restoring, the very thing that he's giving them back. The very thing. Do you remember what the new covenant really is? He says, it's the new covenant in my blood. He says, it's the new covenant. He says, I'm laying down my life for this covenant because you didn't do it. I'm sacrificing myself once for all. I'm sacrificing myself so that you cannot pay for your sin anymore. I'm sacrificing myself for this new covenant. And what is the new covenant? That he would write his word on every heart. heart. According to Jeremiah, that the time is coming that everybody will have the law written on their heart. So he takes away the temple system. And the new treaty is now inaugurated. There cannot be sacrifice anymore. There is one sacrifice forever. He will not... Do you hear what I'm saying to you? Do you hear? You cannot take away your own sin anymore. You cannot walk around feeling the guilt of that. If you do, if what you're doing is you're picking it up. Because he's already taken it away. This group who's at the Passover meal, who are they? They're the representatives of the 12 tribes of Israel. Celebrating the Feast of Weeks and celebrating the Exodus. The very thing that released them from Egypt. And now here they are. This group, who represents the 12 tribes of Israel, and who picked those 12? Anyone? Who picked them? Jesus. Handpicked these 12 guys. Who were tax collectors, sinners, rich, poor, insurrectionists, military guys who wanted to fight. And what he does is he picks them to represent Israel. And he takes them and collects them, a group of people that should have nothing in common. And he makes them his people. He makes them the representatives of Israel. So this group that's at the table, what is it that is promised? He's saying it's a vivid illustration of this diversity of who Israel should have been, but who he's now writing the law on to, making them, as Peter puts it, living epistles. They are becoming themselves an illustration of what God's kingdom really is. And the way that he's doing that is over this Passover meal. What he's doing is over the Feast of Weeks, this week-long celebration, getting this room ready and calling these people together at a common table. What does a table represent? A table represents family. The family, the tribes, who they were originally called to be, calls them to the table. And what he does at that table is he takes the common elements on the table, the wine and bread, and he tells them that it's over. I'm going to end this sacrificial system. I'm doing this by making myself the sacrifice. This cup is the cup of the new covenant, of the new treaty that I'm making with you, the one that Jeremiah spoke of. My blood is the thing that's going to initiate how we are opening the borders of the kingdom to everyone as represented by you guys, by you 12. And I will open the borders, and I will do it. The way I'm doing it is not with military might. I will do it with my blood. I will do it with my broken body. And if what we'll do is we'll gather to celebrate the Exodus, if we'll gather to celebrate the release from bondage that way, what I'm going to do is take the same celebration, and I am showing you with the elements from that celebration the real Exodus, the Exodus was that you, I'm not going to allow you to live in the bondage of your own sin, of your own perverted religion, where you think you're better than everyone else. I am delivering you from that. I am doing the Jeremiah thing. I am bringing you out from under it. You are dying, and the sacrificial is dying, and I am going to be resurrected. And then you follow me. What we've done is we've instituted communion. And communion is good. It's good for us to do communion. We believe in the ordinances. They are wonderful worship elements. Communion sits back at that table every single week, and I don't understand why anybody doesn't go back and partake of it. The early church did. We are joining the great cloud of witnesses. We are joining the church for 2,000 years who have done this, and we are agreeing with them. And it sits back there every week. But that's an ordinance. That's a process for leading us into a remembrance, into worship. What Jesus institutes is something common. It's the elements on the table. We've turned it into an ordinance, which is good. It's worshipful. What Jesus did was he talked about when you get together and everybody's the same. You're all different, but at this table, you're family. Not one above another. And so when you sit at your table and you pick up your slice of pizza and your Coke One, we're to do it in remembrance of him. We are supposed to look at each other and discern the body of Christ. Because that's truly what communion is. He comes breezing into town on a peace cult. They force him, or try to force him, to be a military leader. He takes them away and begins to teach them how the new covenant has arrived, the new peace deal between God and man, the real peace deal between God and man. And he does it over a common table with common food. Now, what I want to ask you is, who's at your table? Who's in your circles? People who are just like you? Is that the only people that you feel are worthy for you to hang around? Who's at your table? I read something today up at Lehigh Valley Grace Brethren Church that I want to read to you. This is from John chapter 17. When Jesus prays for his guys, he instructs them on what's going to happen, and he prepares them, and he tells them to expect the Holy Spirit, and he says a whole lot of things to them, and he's preparing them for this really dangerous time and going forward. But this is interesting. Listen to this. My prayer is not for them alone. He's praying as he sings. He prays for himself, and he prays for his guys. And now he says, my prayer is not for them alone. Listen. I pray also for those who will believe in me through their message, that all of them may be one. Father, just as you are in me and I am in you, may they also be in us, so that the world may believe that you have sent me. Who's he praying for? Yeah, Glenn. Us. And unless exercise this idea of diversity, how will the world believe that the Father is in the Son, that we're in Him? How will they know who He is? So who is at your table? At Jesus' table was an enemy, wasn't there? One who betrayed Him, probably thought He was doing right, had His own agenda, maybe, probably thought He was serving God, but He was an enemy. He was a betrayer. And just understand that He was handpicked and placed there by the Lord. Do we have any right then in ourselves to decide who's not worthy to be at our table? If we have any fellowship with Him, if we have been rescued from bigotry, it isn't for us. We haven't been rescued for us. We've been rescued for everybody else who doesn't know that. That's a high calling. It's what was illustrated in that first film. I know it was weird, the mystery. There's a priesthood of all believers. We are all responsible to carry this message, and it's because of the broken body and the blood. If we will do that, I think we better get a really big table.
Have been listening to Beside Still Waters Netcast. For more information about Still Waters and its ministries, please visit besidestillwaters.net.